I'm Shane Morris. Thanks for listening to the Breakpoint Podcast. What are the elements of good literature? And what do Christian writers and storytellers have access to that unbelieving authors don't? According to author Jonathan Rogers, we have a truer story to tell. Today on the Breakpoint Podcast, Warren Smith talks to Jonathan Rogers about that truer story and about the writers who influenced Rogers in his work, including Flannery O'Connor and Mark Twain. Here are Warren Cole Smith and Jonathan Rogers.
Jonathan Rogers, welcome to the program. And, you know, you're interested in so many of the same things that I'm interested in that it's hard to figure out how to focus our conversation. But I think I'm going to start with your book, The Terrible Speed of Mercy, a spiritual biography of Flannery O'Connor, for several reasons. Number one is that I think it allows us to talk about a lot of the ideas that we want to talk about elsewhere. Yeah. Number two, I love the book. I thought it was great.
Oh, great.
I've
thanks.
Read a lot about Flannery O'Connor. You know this about my background, that you know, I studied under a man who knew Flannery O'Connor personally, Andrew Lytle. I did my master's thesis on Andrew Lytle, who taught Flannery O'Connor. So I wouldn't say I've read everything there is to read about Flannery O'Connor, but I've read most everything there is to read, and this is the best of it right here, your book.
Thank you.
So let me just start with your interest. You're from Middle Georgia.
Yeah.
Flannery O'Connor's from Milledgeville, not quite the same town. Was she just in the air? Was she just in the water when you were growing up?
No, I wouldn't say she was in the air or in the water. I don't know that she's in the air anywhere in terms of everybody knowing. Well, except insofar as, if you read her letters and her language she uses there is so familiar to a Middle Georgia native.
Yeah. I mean, came to that later, right?
I did come to that much later.
Yeah.
So it's not like I even heard that much about Flannery O'Connor. Though once you start asking around, a lot of people have little stories here and there about Flannery O'Connor.
So how did you run across her then? Did you have to read her in high school or something?
I probably read A Good Man Is Hard to Find in high school, read her in college, and just really loved her. You know, I was very much in sort of John Milton mode during college and didn't quite appreciate Flannery O'Connor the way I needed to, the way I wish I had. You know, I went on and got a PhD in Milton. So it was really after my sort of academic career was winding down, so to speak, that I got interested in Flannery O'Connor. More as when I needed somebody to help me find my voice as a writer as opposed to an academic.
Yeah.
You know, and that's when I really, when I realized, wait a minute, maybe I'm not an academic so much as just a writer.
Well, and I do want to talk about especially your Wilder King trilogy in just a bit, but let's stick with Flannery O'Connor before
we
transition to some of these other issues. So you maybe read her a little bit. You probably read the short stories.
Right.
You know, you read those short stories, and you do hear a little bit of that Southern voice, but I think you're right. It's more in the letters that it comes out. When did you discover the letters, which for those in the know, it's called The Habit of Being, and it came out, I believe, in the 1970s. Sally Fitzgerald.
It might have been the 80s. But
was it 80s? Okay, you would know more than I'll accept your authority on that subject. Sally Fitzgerald edited them, which were, a masterful editing job. She was lovingly edited. Sally Fitzgerald and Robert Fitzgerald, of course, were close with Flannery O'Connor and loved her. And put her best foot forward with that book. Was that what did it for you, the letters?
I think it probably was. When I read those letters, I thought, good grief, she's my people. You know, her voice, she kind of looks like, in a lot of her, some of her better photographs, she looks like my mother when my mother was that age and young. And so just everything about her just made me just feel like, oh, this is kind of my people, the way she talks, the way she, just her interests. I mean, not that my family's especially interested in serial killers, but there's this sort of her humor is, I don't know that I'm not making any particular claims for Middle Georgia's, and there's a unique humor in Middle Georgia, but there's something about, there actually was a genre, a sort of sub genre called Middle Georgia humor back when the 19th century humorists were kind of doing their thing.
Yeah.
And she very much comes out of that. I mean, it's I don't think people are as aware as they could be of how she and Mark Twain have so many of the same influences in terms of the humorous of the 19th century.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that Middle Georgia is, you know, so much. And, I mean, all of her stories, with maybe rare exceptions, are set, you know, in Georgia. I mean, I remember that in one of the letters, she gets asked at some college, you know, why did the man in his story wear a black hat? Is that a symbol of evil? And she just says, well, in my part, in the part of Georgia I come from, men wear hats and they are often black, or something like that.
Yeah, right.
It was very much, she was describing what she saw all around her.
Yeah, and I think the other thing I love about about her so much. And again, this is sort of an accident of birth. It's not, again, I'm not making any particular claims for, it's just that that happens to be the part of the world I'm from. The way that she saw, there was a really mythical, she saw the stuff of Middle Georgia.
Yeah.
And saw, you know, it might as well, and I'm mimicking somebody here, I can't remember who, said that for her, you know, Middle Georgia was her Thebes, you know. Mm-hmm. And that the person to compare her to, it's not this sort of Southern Gothic writers, it's Sophocles. And so the way she sort of took the everyday stuff of Middle Georgia and said, this is where the great dramas of sin and judgment and grace play themselves out, that this world is where God does his work.
Yeah.
Man, that just made a huge impact on me as a person, as a writer.
Yeah, well, you know, to me, another thing that's interesting, and I don't want to read too much into this, and you can debunk what I'm about to say, if you will, but there is an accident or a providence in the geography that she's from, that where, you know, you've got these fields that are often surrounded by woods. Uh-huh. You know, whereas if you look at Western literature, it's wide open spaces.
Huh.
But in the South, it's not so much that. It's river swamps and, mm-hmm. and subtropical rainforests that have been cleared. And so there's just always kind of this mystery we can see so far, mm-hmm. but then there's those mysterious woods beyond. And that's both a part of her theology and a part of the geography of her place.
I've never given this much thought, but I think you're making a good point here, that the wide openness of Western literature is one thing. And in Flannery O'Connor's literature, it's not so wide open. I mean, there's people everywhere, some of whom mean one another harm.
Yeah,
you're always dealing with relationships with people. In the East, you're always rubbing up against somebody in a way that maybe in the West you can. The mythology of the West is aloneness.
Yeah, yeah.
However accurate that is, but you know, it is the mythology.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The wilderness, the, you know, lighting out for the territory, mm-hmm. of Huck Finn kind of thing. Back to Flannery O'Connor and sort of the theology and so on. We can't spend so much at this late date has been written about Flannery mm-hmm. O'Connor and journals and books and all kinds of things. But I am interested in this one aspect, and that is that you mentioned Milton earlier. You know, Milton once described his audience as fit though few. And in some ways, that's Flannery O'Connor's audience as well.
Certainly when she was alive. Right?
Yeah.
She's more popular now than ever.
That's right. Well, that's the point I was going to make. She is more popular now than ever. She did okay while she was alive. Mm-hmm. But since she's died, and maybe it's Sally Fitzgerald's letters that helped a lot of that, and I think there was a posthumous collection or her complete stories that won a National Book Award or Pulitzer or something like that. Yeah. I don't remember what it was. That probably helped as well. But why is it today, do you think, young people, a lot of young people, I know my adult kids have discovered Flannery O'Connor and they just love her. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that she's had staying power now, 60 years, 70 years after she died?
I think it has something to do with the fact that, I guess, the project of evangelicalism for so long has been demystification. You look at the titles in a Christian bookstore, it's Seven Steps to This, and, you know, it's this sort of...
How to do that. And
yeah, you come face-to-face. It's not coming face-to-face with the mysteries. It's saying, we're going to solve the mysteries. Sort of the project of modernism, period, is to, I say modernism, you know, as distinct from postmodernism, but, you know, in Flannery O'Connor's era, she was always speaking out against that kind of instant uplift, she called it, and instead offering to the reader an opportunity to just sort of dwell in mysteries that are beyond what they can make sense of. Yeah. And so I think in a world in which, you know, the sort of evangelical project has brought us where it has, that sort of demystification, which, you know, can end up being pretty brutal. I think an author who says, hey, why don't we just have a look at these mysteries and not try to solve them, just inhabit them? I think there's a lot of appeal in that.
Well, looking at the mysteries, but also firmly grounded, firmly rooted in, it's not ethereal mysticism.
Sure.
It's thoroughly
Absolutely.
Grounded in Christian dogma and theology.
She was perfectly willing to use the word dogma. Now I'm going to misquote her, but basically she says, dogma is the guardian of mystery. she didn't choose between dogma on the one hand and mystery on the other. You know, and I do think that traditions that are that shy away from dogma end up losing track of the mystery as well, because we have to have some kind of certainty. And so if that has to be seven steps to your best life now or whatever, then we'll end up taking that if we don't embrace dogma. And the dogma allows us to live with mystery.
And is that maybe one of the reasons why so many of the great fantasy writers, C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, have also been deeply rooted, firmly grounded in dogma and theology, do you think?
Yes. I mean, you think about somebody like Tolkien who's looking to, is the word remythology? I don't know if that's the right precise enough term, but to awaken us to the mythical possibilities of the world around us by inventing a new world. And I think that's one thing that's different about Flannery O'Connor's approach to storytelling, was to remind us of, both of them are sort of reinvigorating the idea of mystery in mythology. But for O'Connor, it was, I'm not going to make up a new world. I'm going to show you this world right here. Here's a doctor's office where these mysteries are playing themselves out. Here's a dairy farm. You know, here's a city bus. Whereas you got Tolkien and Lewis sort of making up new worlds where
The example that you just used from one of Flannery O'Connor's most famous stories, some people would argue her best story, Revelation, which starts in that doctor's office. And one of the things, it really is an example of what you just said. I mean, she's showing humankind.
Human development, right? The girl's reading the human development textbook.
That's right, the sociology book, Human Development. And but showing them, though, in their sickness. They're in the doctor's office. There's something wrong with everyone in that room, or they wouldn't be there.
Yeah, right.
Right? And then by the time you get to the end of that story, there is a vision of mystery, mm-hmm. of grace. That's the reason the story's called a revelation.
Yeah.
And a part of that revelation is, you know, Ruby Turpin understanding that we're all sinners in need of a Savior, even though she doesn't quite, and Flannery O'Connor doesn't quite put it in those terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that story because it's one of the few places where in the fiction, Flannery O'Connor says, here, y'all, here's what I've been doing in all these stories.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
She didn't mind being misunderstood. And thankfully, this wasn't too long before she died that she wrote Revelation. And thankfully, she finally wrote a story where she said, here's what I'm really doing. I love that story.
Hey, everybody. Warren Smith here. And I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Jonathan Rogers. And if you are, I want to tell you about an event that I think you're going to love. As you may know, the Colson Center hosts its annual Wilberforce Weekend in May of each year, and this year it'll take place on May 17 through 19 in Washington, D.C. But this year we're doing a little something extra. All day Friday, May 17, we'll have Jonathan Rogers and the rest of the team from the Rabbit Room with us for a special pre-conference. In addition to Jonathan, we'll have Douglas McKelvey and Andrew Peterson. In fact, Andrew will be closing the day with a short concert that I know you won't want to miss. To find out more about the entire Wilberforce Weekend, including this special Rabbit Room on the Road pre-conference, go to wilberforceweekend.com. That's wilberforceweekend.com. Look forward to seeing you there. Jonathan, there was an old TV commercial. I forget what it's even for now. It's where this guy stands up and says, "I like the product so much, I bought the company." I don't remember. It's a razor blade or something that. And I think about that for some reason whenever I think about you. I mean, you're an academic. You've got a PhD
in 17th century.
Yeah. But now you've become a writer yourself, and I don't mean a writer of nonfiction, but of fiction.
Yeah, right.
The Wilder King trilogy is, I've heard it described as a fantasy with an American accent, which resonated with me, because when I do think about a lot of the fantasies like the Narnia and Lord of the Rings, there is something very British about those, right?
Yeah, British or Northern. Yeah.
Right, yeah. But you were very intentional about this kind of being an American story?
Yeah. I mean, it's an imaginary, the Wilder King is set in an imaginary place, but that place looks suspiciously like South Georgia or Florida. because those are places that have always felt very sort of mysterious and mythical to me too. I mean, there's alligators there, for crying out loud. It's like, yeah. There's dragons who live in these places. Who, I grew up in a place that didn't have alligators when I was born, and then the alligators came back. And as the alligators came back, it was as if dragons have come to my hometown. First time I saw an alligator in the wild, it was just this staggering experience. I was, probably 18 or 19 years old, but the alligators, I was very aware that they used to live in Middle Georgia, and then they went away, and then as they came back, it was, and I realized this is 9 miles from my house, and there's an alligator here.
Well, we're talking about alligators because, in some ways they're an accident of geography, shall we say, but in other ways they're not either. I mean, I've heard it said that there are only really three kinds of stories, and one of them is Slay the Dragon, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And the others are also in your...
Goes on a trip.
Yeah,
right?
Because of a quest story. Yeah.
Well, if the Wilder King stories sort of retell the David story, although as you get deeper into the trilogy, the parallels are maybe not quite as obvious to a young reader. But within the David story, you have the Slay the Giant story.
Yeah.
You have the quest story where Saul sends him off to bring back, 100 Philistine foreskins or whatever. Is it 100? Do I have that right?
I don't remember.
A
large number, yeah. Shall we say.
And then there's the Robin Hood story where he's hiding out in the caves and canyons as an outlaw, trying to sort of establish some kind of world of order when the whole world around him is disordered.
What can you say a little bit more about that one? I think people kind of understand the first two, but the Robin Hood story is not, to me, as obvious an archetypal story. I mean, we know mm-hmm. the story of Robin Hood, but help me understand that a little bit more. I mean, is this a quest for trying to understand what's good and what's evil, what's right and what's wrong, the way we should relate to authority? And
yeah, I mean, the David that's always been such a fascinating part of David's story to me. I mean, in general, just the idea of, hey, you're a boy and you're going to be king someday, but you're not yet. What's it like to live in that gap? And that's really, in many ways, what the Wilder King stories are about. But such an important part of that in the David story is, what do you do when the people who've told you that all these things about who God is, when they're not living it, when they tell you that Jehovah reigns and yet they're cowering in fear before this giant, what's a boy supposed to do with that? Or in the case of when he's in the caves hiding out from Saul, as you said, this is a question of what's our relationship to authority. And it's very complicated. And I think it's something that young people deal with all the time.
Yeah. Well, in your books, the Wilder King Trilogy, who would you say are your literary forebears? Would it be Tolkien? Would it be Lewis? Or would it be Mark Twain?
I mean, I came to understand this more as I got into it, that it's Mark Twain more than... I mean, it's all three of them. But the more I... Like so many young writers, when you set out, young Christian writers of fiction, your first go-to is somebody like Lewis. And I thought of Lewis as a model. But as I sort of found my own voice, I realized, wait a minute, this is more... Some reviewer pointed out some parallels between, I guess it was my second book, and Huck Finn. And at first I said, no, I didn't think about Huck Finn once. But then I realized, I think about Huck Finn all the time. I just don't even know I'm thinking about Huck Finn.
Right. Yeah. He's in the air, he's in the water kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Twain is an exceedingly important influence for me. Also, the people who influenced Twain were important influences, on me, which ends up looking like very similar to being influenced by Twain, right?
Well, can you be say a little bit more about that and be more specific? Because when I think of Twain, for example, I think about that troubled relationship to authority. Mm-hmm. I think about lighting out for the territory.
Yeah,
I don't know if we would necessarily want to call it Western literature. I've once heard it said that all American literature is Western literature. That if you read the Scarlet Letter, for example, that was the West. Mm-hmm. Massachusetts was the West.
Yeah,
and then by the time you get to, Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn, the Trans-Mississippi was the West.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether I buy that, but I do think that the idea of exploring a frontier, going to the edge of the frontier, and then deciding whether to put down roots or to go into that unknown territory,
yeah,
probably is an important part of the American experience. It also seems to be an important part of what you're describing in your books as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, my stories are very much frontier stories. For those, the very reasons you're saying here, what does it mean to, we all have this kind of wild streak in us that's there for some reason. And I don't think it's just that we're, you know, weak and wounded, sick and sore. I don't think this is just the fall or that it's just sin. I think there's a reason, there's a wildness in us.
Yeah.
And I think maybe Americans are a little more in touch, for better or worse, Americans have traditionally been a little more in touch.
Well, I hate to sort of do a Jesus juke on you and get theological, but, you know, I've heard it said that Satan doesn't create, he only corrupts. And mm-hmm. that wildness that's in us, having, you know, God made us holy and pure and put us in a wild place. He put us in a garden,
yeah.
told us to cultivate that garden. I mean, that being comfortable with that wildness and doing something with that wildness, that frontier, seems to me a prelapsarian condition, shall we say. And again, I don't want to get too theological on you, but
yeah.
but it does kind of make sense that what Satan has done is corrupt that sense and not create that sense in us.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think all those themes are, they inhere in the David story. And the first time I really understood the extent to which the David story felt like a Western was Leap Over a Wall, Eugene Peterson's book, Leap Over a Wall.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I didn't read, it wasn't that I read the book. I heard the sermon series that the book was based on, and then the book came out. And it just set me on fire. You know, I just wanted to tell that story. And then I wanted to sort of transpose it to an American setting that seemed very appropriate to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jonathan, to pivot just a little bit in our conversation, yeah. you know, I'm having this conversation with you. I've had Andrew Peterson on the program before. Claire Gibson, I just interviewed uh-huh. about her new novel, and she's a student of yours. It seems to me that there are a lot of Christians who are grappling deeply with some of these questions that you're grappling with. You know, what it means to be an artist in this postmodern world mm-hmm. as a Christian, how to tell stories that touch some of these ancient ideas, but do so in ways that readers today can resonate with yeah. and connect with.
Yeah.
Am I making this up or am I seeing something here?
I think you're seeing something, sure. I mean,
do you intentionally see yourselves as part of a movement or are you just doing your thing?
I don't think in terms of a movement necessarily. I assume there have always been Christian storytellers trying to do what they can to sort of help people align themselves with something that's truer than the stories that the world is telling them. You know, I mean, I think that's the Christian's role in the world, whether they're a storyteller or a parent or whatever, is just sort of offering a counter narrative that says, oh, all these other stories that you're hearing from the world, there may be some truth in there, but here's something truer. And that's, I count it a privilege to have the opportunity to sort of tell some stories that maybe help people align with something that's true. And that's the funny thing about fiction is we think of it in terms of, it's not that we're making up imaginary worlds so much as saying, here's a vision of reality. I think that's the real value to stories. And the stories that by the way, align us with something that's not real aren't especially helpful stories. Although I think it's pretty hard to tell a story that doesn't have any kind of reality, any relationship to reality.
Jonathan, I'd like to pivot once again in our conversation, and rather than talk specifically about your work, mm-hmm. I want to talk about your place in a larger community, which yeah. we've also kind of alluded to, and that is the Rabbit Room yeah. community. You know, you are here in Nashville. Andrew Peterson's here in Nashville. Pete Peterson, his brother, is here yeah. in Nashville. Doug McKelvey,
yeah.
A whole lot of others that are kind of have this loose affiliation as, you know, being members of the Rabbit Room.
Yeah.
Tell me how that came about from your point of view, how you got involved with these guys, whether you guys see yourself in, like, as I maybe have asked earlier, intentionally as part of a yeah. movement, or are you just doing your thing and are nurtured by the friendship and the association?
Yeah, that term, for whatever reason, I wasn't comfortable with that term movement, because that sounds like a kind of, I don't know what it sounds like, but the Rabbit Room starts with friendship. I mean, you know, it got started when, you know, Andrew just sort of invited some of his friends who also happen to be writers or artists or songwriters or whatever, who are Christian people and who shared those interests and kind of said, why don't we start a blog? Why don't we, I mean, it's kind of was Rabbit Room started as a blog and then, but also these were people who were friends with each other, or in any case, they were all friends with Andrew and then became friends with each other because Andrew's kind of a connector anyway, kind of collects people, collects friends in the best possible sense, you know. And so many of my most important friendships now came out of that connection. Because now that I think about it, I guess I didn't actually know many of the Rabbit Room people before the Rabbit Room started, but it's through the Rabbit Room that I got to know the various people who are mixed up with it.
Well, I do wonder out loud here just a minute, and you can correct me or affirm it. Your uncomfortableness with the word movement, in part, I wonder if it doesn't stem from the fact that in some ways you're like, it's like the anti-movement. I mean, you know, it really started as a friendship, and friendships that quote unquote have an agenda that are trying, you know, where I'm trying to get you to do something or I sense that you're trying to get me to do something. They don't last, but true friendship is not about what you can do for me. It's rooted in love. It's rooted in caring for the other person. It's rooted in service. I mean, is that fair?
And as it turns out, that's an exceedingly generative position.
And by that, you mean it's fruitful. It produces great
fruit. For my part, I think I would have. Writing's hard.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I would have kept doing it if I hadn't had these friends who were encouraging me, reminding me that it was important. Also to look around and say, oh yeah, this isn't easy for anybody, at least not for any of the creators of these people who I respect their work so much. And it looks, when you see the finished product and it looks so polished and good, to realize, no, that was a really hard process for them.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, a couple of weeks ago I interviewed a guy named Joe LeConte who wrote a book about Lewis and Tolkien and the Great War, World War One. And one of the things that he talked about was just how important the friendship was between those two to their work. Joe LeConte said about Lewis and Tolkien exactly what you just said, or almost exactly what you just said about the folks that you're working with or associated with in the Rabbit Room, which is that it was both of them would have probably given up.
Yeah.
Probably more so Tolkien on Middle Earth. Without Lewis's support, without Lewis saying, this is important, you need to keep doing it. And it's hard to imagine that today when you think about all the, you know, billions of dollars and hundreds of millions of people that have, you know, that have been nourished by that book, that it just almost didn't happen but for a friendship. It probably wouldn't have happened.
Yeah. These stories, they appear all the time. The friendships that resulted in good work. And sometimes work that, you know, you've never heard of either, right? But there's something about having somebody alongside you with a shared interest that spurs you on to love and good deeds, right?
Yeah. Well, so this friendship, which has resulted in a lot of great individual work, is recently started to kind of come together into a more intentional community. I mean, you guys are doing, for example, the Rabbit Room on the Road with the Colson Center this spring, which we're really excited about. How did that come about?
I thought you had something to do with it coming about, Warren. Didn't
Well, I had it to do with you guys being at the Colson Center. I might have played a role in that, but I think its genesis was in Hutchmoot.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah. So Hutchmoot is our annual gathering. I guess you'd call it a conference, but you've been to Hutchmoot, haven't you?
I have. Yeah.
You've been to a lot of conferences. Right.
Yeah, it's kind of the anti-conference.
Yeah. Kind of is,
you know,
isn't it?
It's like we were talking about the anti-movement.
Yeah, right.
In some ways, is the anti-conference.
It's terrible for networking. Like, it's not a good place to sort of make business connections. And if you do sort of bring your manuscript for somebody to look at, it's kind of frowned on. You know, it's just not a – it's everything people go to conferences for. It's Hutchmoot's not a good place for it. But it's a great place to sit down and have a meal with somebody you've never met before and to talk about – some topic that you might share an interest in, or maybe you didn't realize you shared an interest in until you got there.
Yeah, yeah.
The Hutchmoot is kind of this embodiment of what we were hoping to accomplish in the blog, but you just can't accomplish online. You can't sit across a table from somebody and talk to them on the internet.
Well, one of the things that was interesting to me about Hutchmoot was Russell Moore, who is with the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. He's often involved in policy matters, and he's on Capitol Hill. He was teaching a class on, I think, Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
And at Hutchmoot. Yeah. There were people there, you know, you go to the quote-unquote the exhibit hall, where everybody's sort of peddling, normally you would see, booths. There was a potter there.
Yeah.
There was a leather worker there.
Yeah, right.
And I mean, and they weren't just, selling pots or selling belts. They were making them on the spot.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you could watch them and pick up a hammer and hit a piece of leather if you wanted to.
Yeah. 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 I mean, Hutchmood is such, it's sort of like Christmas, for instance. What am I? Probably my favorite weekend of the year, just the time to sort of gather and see friends that you don't see all that often who share this interest in the arts, in faith, in the ways that community nurtures art, and the way that art nurtures community or friendship. Yeah.
Well, I do wonder, and you and I have had some of these conversations off mic, Jonathan, but I mean, is this a transferable concept? I mean, a lot of Nashville is a unique place.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's got, other communities have other uniquenesses. I guess if that's the way to say that.
Uniqueries, I think is the word.
Do what?
Uniqueries.
Uniqueries. Oh, there we go. And but Nashville is unusual, to say the least.
Yeah,
and
it is.
And so I know a lot of people come to Hutchmood encouraged as I was, and then I go back to my home of Charlotte and say, oh man, I sure wish we could do this here.
Yeah.
And discover that it's probably not going to look like this in Charlotte.
That's true enough, right? It's just not whatever gets put together in another place isn't going to look like what gets put together in this place. But that's just the fact of the way the world works.
That's not a reason not to do it. That's not a reason to build whatever is unique to your space, your
right.
place.
Yeah, I mean that's what's so gorgeous about this world, is that every place has its own signature and its own. But also I think this is a really important point. I mentioned this earlier. Creativity is, the arts are just a relatively small wedge of the pie that is creativity. Every time you are telling a truer story than the one the world is telling, whether that's in entrepreneurship or in hospitality or writing stories, whatever it is, I mean, every time Christian people live out the kingdom of God and say, here's something that's truer. You've got the city of God that's sort of trying to make its way here in the city of man, and to tell the story of the city of God and say, no, we are citizens of this city. I think there's a clue there. As it turns out, the people that started the Rabbit Room, they are in the arts. That's true enough. And I think the artist's job is to equip people to be creative well beyond the arts in telling that truer story. And so I don't know that at the Rabbit Room we have yet sorted out how to do this, but I think that's our calling, is not to create arts communities, but to equip people to be creative in ways that go way, way beyond the arts. And the great thing about the arts is that they're especially good, I think, at helping other people be creative in other areas beyond the arts. But to sort of elevate the arts as if they are the be-all, end-all of even something like the Rabbit Room, I think is a mistake.
Well, there's also another element of this that comes to my mind, and that is that God made the whole world, not just mm-hmm. Nashville, or not just
That's right.
Colorado Springs, or not just New York, or L.A., or Washington, or Hollywood. He made it all.
Mm-hmm.
And even in Jesus' day, they were saying, can anything good come out of Nazareth, right?
Yeah.
And Flannery O'Connor, nobody thought of Milledgeville, Georgia, as a hotbed for artistic activity she was there in the 1950s and early 60s. So it's to be obedient wherever God has put you, it seems to me, is an important part of this.
Yeah. And I hope at the Rabbit Room we'll get better at equipping people to not look to the sort of central, to think of Nashville as the Vatican of the Rabbit Room, but we can do a better job of helping people do their thing where they are.
Jonathan, I hope you have, you're still a young man, especially compared to me, and I hope you have many, many more great years of writing and teaching and other things ahead of you. But I know you're enough of a Bible scholar to know that what the Bible says is true, and that is that one day we will all die.
Yes.
How do you want people to remember you? How do you want people to remember the work of Jonathan Rogers?
Well, forgive me because this is the third time I brought it up, but this has been such an important idea for me of the idea of telling a truer story. I hope I'm remembered as somebody who told some stories that were truer than the ones the world was telling. Yeah. And stories that help people to resort to Augustine. And Augustine hadn't even come up this whole time. That helps make it clear what properly ordered loves look like.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's Breakpoint Podcast with Warren Smith and Jonathan Rogers. And remember, for more information on the upcoming Wilberforce Weekend, come to wilberforceweekend.org.